I remember my mother came out and saw me graduate.
Oh, she took a train out?
Yes, she did. She took a train out to watch me graduate.
And what base was this again?
Williams, Arizona. It was in July and was this hot. We used to have to wear gloves to get on the airplane because you...
Burn your hand?
Burn your hand, yeah. And she saw me graduate and she says to me, yeah, I know everything's going to be all right with you. You're going to get through this all right. So anyway, she says, you know, you're going to come home and leave? I said, well, I'm supposed to. She says, okay. You say goodbye to everybody and close the book. And I did.
So you flew the PT-17. What else did you fly in training?
Well, in basic, I went up to Lemoore, which is in central Joaquin Valley, San Joaquin Valley prison over there. Anyway, yeah, I went to Hanford, and the BT-13s, you know.
Oh, the multivibrator.
Yeah, I flew them. That was easy. That was a good airplane. That was easy. And from there, I went to twin-engine fighter school in Williams, Arizona, where I first introduced to the P-322, the P-38, you know. And the British called it the 322 because they wanted their props going the same direction. Now, I can't imagine the P-38 with the props, but that was what made the airplane. We had counter-rotating props. There we start out with the AT-9, the flying shot put. That sucker was the hardest airplane ever flew in my life. That thing used to float down the runway. In Arizona, it used to float down the runway forever on the land. It used to just float and float and float. That's where I got a real hunk of anti-Semitism. I mean, my first instructor is Lieutenant Gregor. And so he pulled me aside. We went to the airplane. I tell you this, I hate Jews. I don't like Jews. And I'm going to wash you out. He says, you're kidding. I says, well, do you ever know a Jew? He says, I don't have to know a Jew. You're Christ killers. I ignored it. Showed this guy. Well, from the minute I got in that area, I couldn't do anything right for him. He did everything in the world to wash me out. One day, we took off and he cut one of the engines. You know, and no one ever told me that he was going to cut an engine. And he said, I just cut the other engine and landed. And I knew enough about that airplane that it wouldn't go around on one engine. And I'm going to wash you out for that boy. We got on the ground, and that's when I tore into him. I said to him, you're not going to do a goddamn thing. And I really told him off that, and I'm going to ask for a check ride, and I think you ought to have your head examined. And so I went to Captain Smith, I forget his first name. I said, sir, I seem to be having a problem with being Jewish here. I didn't know that would be a problem, and I want a check ride. He says, oh, is it giving you a problem? I said, yeah. He says, always trying to wash out Jewish kids. I said, haven't you people gotten the message yet? So anyway, they gave me a captain. He was Jewish. He said, I got to do something about that. He says, I think I'll get someone to kick him in the groin. And I says, I'd like to have the job, but I wouldn't be able to get away with it.
This ship, was a part of a convoy or by itself?
Yeah, well, we were over 100 ships.
Do you remember, the month you departed?
October.
43.
Yeah, October 43. Remember October 43. I don't know that thing. But it's funny, the night before we departed, they went to a service, and a little rabbi, a new rabbi, and he was so upset. He was crying because he couldn't give us anything. He couldn't give me anything to take with me, except he gave me the little sitter. And
one of those olive drab prayer books?
Yeah, and... He was crying. He couldn't give us anything. I said, I'm all prepared, Rabbi. I got that from my mother.
Where did you meet this rabbi? Was this in Virginia?
Yeah, in the Hampton Roads at the debarkation center, where everybody got on the boat. Said, we just very quietly got on the boat one night. The next morning we sailed. The next morning we're out at sea.
So prior to this, like you say, you were in Norristown and said goodbye to everybody?
My family. I said goodbye. My family. I said my brothers were in the service. I didn't see them for all the time. I said my sisters, my mother, and my girlfriend, and my friends. I didn't say goodbye.
Oh, I know what you mean.
Kind
of say hello, actually.
Mentally, I put them, this is, just saying goodbye to everybody. Their maintenance problems were terrible. It made the airplane not very effective in that theater. We had no problem like that. We had no maintenance problem. Very rarely would a P-38 blow an engine.
Would you attribute that to the humidity and cold weather of England?
No. I was talking to our former commanding officers, Colonel Taylor, Oliver B. Taylor. We call him Obie. And I said to him, Obie, what do you attribute this to? He says, number one, bad command. Number two, bad maintenance, horrible maintenance. And at our latest thing down there, our reunion, Tony LeVere just confirmed that. Obie told me this some time ago. It was bad command and bad maintenance. Now, Tony LeVere told me down at the our latest reunion last week that pretty much the same thing. The commanding officer in charge of the whole thing hated P-38s. And he said, how would you like to have a commanding officer who hated the airplane you're flying in combat,
So they're attributing that to the human element, not the machine.
That's right. Agree. And the only time I had an engine blow on takeoff is when I was in the States, overseas. I never had an engine blow on takeoff, and that was scary. It was a piggyback. I was teaching a new pilot. I did everything. Everything looked good to me when, because I was very careful. Another thing I did, too, pull back. One of the things about a P-38 is you pull back on the stick. When it runs down the runway, you get up to 105, then
yes,
you pull it off. That plane just will not fly off the ground by itself. A lot of pilots were killed thinking that.
You had to pull it up in the air.
You had to actually pull back on the stick, and the thing would just leap off the ground. Well, I would pull it back at 105, and then I wouldn't get up at altitude until it was 150. Then I'd start climbing. I wanted that extra speed in case I did blow an engine. Because what happens, if you blow an engine, you have 1,500 horsepower on one side and a dead engine on the other side. Guess what happens? Flip you on your back, just within seconds. So what I would do would be to get up altitude, and when this thing actually blew, this engine actually blew, I could feel that something was wrong is happening. I'd chop both throttles, put all the trim tab into the good engine and start slowly give throttle to the good engine and feather the other one.
I see.
And that has to be done within 5 seconds.
Were you able to take off in that configuration?
Now, I'll tell you, Tony LeVere used to be able to take off.
On one?
Yeah, on one engine. I never wanted to try it. There's no point to it. I wasn't out there to prove anything. He used to put on demonstrations where he would fly over the field doing all kinds of rolls and everything on one engine, I didn't want to do that. I wasn't getting paid to kill myself. I admired him and everything, but it was nice to know that you could do that. But I didn't see all that demonstration until after I came back from overseas.
You flew 50 missions. I guess that was your quota.
Yeah.
Was combat flying more difficult physically or mentally?
Physically and mentally, because when you're in a fight, you're always turning, pulling G's all the time. And when you finish, you're just wrung out. Just wrung out. And you're watching the sky, and your head's always on a spindle. You're always moving. And you can always tell a fighter pilot when you're walking down the street, his head's always moving, back and forth, down, turning around. And mentally, yeah, it was a stress. Didn't realize it until you got down on the ground and tried to sleep that night. You realize what a stress it was.
It was the constant adrenaline high?
Yeah, it was hard. to get to sleep. I wasn't a drinker, and the guys were, we used to get 2 ounces of Mission liquor, and it was Old Overholt. And I didn't drink, and these guys would drink it and just, you know, settle down, but I never drank.
Did they issue any kind of, like, whiskey also?
What's that? Whiskey what?
A whiskey ration also?
Just that 2 ounces when he came back from the mission, that's all. But there was liquor to be had. There was cognac. There was always cognac to be had.
What would you typically eat for breakfast?
Gee, I had their usual powdered egg. It tasted different each time. Sometimes it tastes like fish. Sometimes it tastes like something else. And bread, and they had Spam. They'd fry up Spam. The food was awful. But most of the time, I would buy oranges. A lot of time, I'd buy oranges and nuts, almonds from the Italians. And I'd eat a lot of oranges and almonds. And sometimes in North Africa, the Arabs would bring eggs around. For a carton of cigarettes, we'd get a dozen eggs.
Real eggs?
Yeah, and they only wanted Lucky Strikes or Camels. They wouldn't take Chesterfields or Philip Morris.
Really?
Yeah, you know, they only want Lucky Strike. For Lucky Strikes, for some reason, you could get anything you wanted.
The other fighter pilots you knew, were they generally extroverts or introverts or one kind of personality type?
A different kind. You had the old Tiger Jones. He just died from cancer. He was a outgoing, gregarious, loud, nice guy, and a tiger. That's why we called him Tiger Jones. And then you'd have a guy named Tipton, who was quiet, reserved, who was a hell of a fighter pilot. And there was no different particular type. Everybody was different.
So, there's no way they could really be categorized.
No way at all. No, believe me.
Did you see Top Gun?
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
Shit. Come on. Who are you kidding? You know, most of the guys, there were no people like that. I know anybody like that. You know, who do that was, that's good theater, but that's about all. Because, you know, for the most part, the pilots that I knew, for the most part, were serious, down to earth, like a businessman. This is my business, and this is how I'm going to do it. I mean, someday when it came to partying, I mean, they were pretty wild when it came to partying.
Yeah.
But when they got in that airplane, it was the office to do anything. Very seldom did I see a guy do something stupid.
Were you allowed to pick your own wingmen, or were they chosen for you?
No, you were told. Unless you talked to the commander before.
Did you have the same wingman throughout most of your time?
No, I didn't. My best wingman was Semple, Semple. He was fantastic. We got separated from the squadron. But Semple and I, over at Ploesti one day, it was the damnedest thing. We were coming in, I think we're supposed to be high target cover that day. And suddenly, a 109, Lone 109, comes right up and sits right in front of a squadron on the left-hand side. I can't get a shot. Pretty soon, everybody in the squadron is shooting, except Semple and I. We're the only one. But there's tracers going by us like crazy. Like, let's get out of here before they shoot us down. Guys were shooting who had no shot on the damn thing. And I just peeled off because I was being, if I'd have stayed there, somebody would have shot me down. This 109 didn't see us. He came right up in front. I don't know where he came from. Right, pulled up right in front of the squadron. Everybody was just dumbfounded. And finally they blew him up. But by that time we were out of there because the guys were shooting at him over us. No, had no shot at him. I don't know what they were shooting at. So we just peeled off, and I peeled off, and he came with me. And that's when suddenly all hell broke loose. And it was a one hell of a fight that day. And we didn't shoot up anything at that point. Later on, coming back home, there was 3 B-24s were flying in formation, and we were coming towards him. I called out a 109 above him, And he said, we got him. Well, this 109 dove straight down. He came up underneath shooting, and one fell out of formation. And I said, he's going to make another pass. And he came down again. I'm coming over. And he shot another one up, and that's when I hit him. And then there's another one that's coming in, and Semple hit that one. And so we shepherded them, the rest of the airplanes, home, as far as we could, out of trouble. Then we were getting low on gas, so we had to leave. And so when we got back, Semple and I, we both claimed, you know. Well, you know, we had that problem with the goddamn camera in the nose.
From the vibration from the guns.
You know, you see this bunch of flap, 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 and nobody. Anyway, this was the second time. No claim. They wouldn't. Nope. You can't confirm each other's. So I held the hell with Semple. Get fight the war and get it over with.
Did Semple survive the war?
No, he was killed. And after the invasion, they were strafing up around Lyon, France. Yeah, and he got killed there.
Was there any fellow aviator who was your best friend throughout all this?
It's hard to do that. Yeah, Hammerline was my best friend. Edgar Hammerline from Huntington, Indiana.
And did he make it?
No, it was horrible. It was hard. I don't want to talk. Tell him, there's a lot I'm not telling you that. I'm going to say no to a lot of things.
How did you adapt yourself to doing what you did 50 times, back and forth all the time?
You know, I was talking to Obie about that. You know, he says, one day ran into the next. You go up. I don't even want, if you mentioned a town or a city, I wouldn't know one from the next, because it was just one after one thing, take off, fly the mission, land. Take off, fly the mission, land. You know, that's what it was, every day. Some days in the afternoon, strafing mission or dive bombing mission. It's just one day ran into the next, you know. There's nothing you could do, you know. That's where it was.
So you just accepted it and did it.
Yeah, you know. You just accepted it and did it. That's all. What choice did I have?
Considering your last name, and I guess the H that was stamped on your dog tags,
yeah,
and the fact that in the latter part of your tour you had Jew Boy on the side of your plane,
yeah,
did you ever wonder or think about the implications of being a POW or being shot down?
No, I never even thought about it.
Never?
Never thought about it.
Uh-huh.
Thought about that, no.
That's something that never entered your mind, the implications of being a POW?
No, because he always thought he was going to get killed.
Either that or come home?
Yeah, either that or I was going to get killed. I'm going to get killed anyway. I'm going to raise hell as long as I can. I was resigned to that when I left. It's funny, when I was at Hampton Roads, Virginia, that's Norfolk. Since we got on the boat to come home, go over there, and the night before, this rabbi comes around, he's talking to me, and he was trying to comfort me.
Was he a chaplain or a rabbi?
He was a rabbi, young rabbi, new young rabbi. I said, I'm sorry, rabbi, I'm not fine, you don't have to comfort me. He says, but you're going into, on that, he described all kinds of horrible things. You're going, you might die. I said, I know, it's okay. And he felt, poor guy, felt sorry for him, that he felt, he wanted to give me something, you know. I'm fine, I'm all set. Don't worry, Rabbi. And he felt so bad for me, you know. And
that you had solace already.
I said, you know, I finally said, but, you know, when I'm over there in danger and all, I'm going to remember talking to you. Made him feel better, but he felt so bad. That's his mission in life, to make us guys feel good, you know.
And you didn't need that.
No, I didn't need it. I'd already said. I said goodbye, everybody, and I just closed the book on home, and, but, you know, that's it. And that's a feeling I'll never get over for all my rest of my life.
Leaving home that time?
That feeling at that time is just something I'll never forget.
I don't know if you want to answer this. When you left that time, Did you expect to return?
No.
You didn't?
No. Yeah, I didn't expect. It never did, because there's so many dangers, you know, and being around the airplanes, you can get killed just being in around one of them. Just ordinary flying, you can get killed. So many dangers, and then on top of that, you're going to be in combat. You're going to be strafing. You're going to be dive bombing. Strafing and dive bombing, Christ, it's a miracle you come through that shit. I mean, there's flak coming up all around you, and you're diving and trying to put that bomb where you want it to be, or you're strafing a field and all kinds of flak's coming up at you, it's a miracle. I figure it's a miracle I'm here. You know, I don't know why I was so lucky.
Of course, you flew 50. Was there any single mission that stands out in your mind as being the most difficult or dangerous?
Well, the one I flew with Seidman. There were others, too. There were others. The Ploesti missions were very, very tough. The one over Munich was a very bad mission. For some reason, the German anti-aircraft fire had figured out the initial IP, the initial point, the bombers were taking, and I saw at least 10 bombers fall out of formation, just get knocked down. You know what the IP is?
Yeah, the initial point.
Yeah, and if they can figure that out, they start sending those shells up there, and oh, God.
And you actually saw the planes get hit and go down?
Uh-huh.
You saw them get hit and go down?
Yeah, lots of them. Just blow up. Some of them, just as they dropped their bombs and made their turn, were being hit. That was tough. That's hard to see. And I see so many of these poor jokers coming back to all shot up. And you try to shepherd them as long as you can until your gas gets low. Then, you know, then you have to get back, then you have to leave them.
About your P-38, when did you get your own P-38?
Gee, I remember getting it. I don't know exactly when, to be honest.
Did you have to fly like a certain number of missions before they gave you
No, it's as they became available. It was availability. And they brought in all these new ones, and I got my own number 47.
How did you ever end up with the name of Jew Boy on the plane?
Well, we kicked it around. We kicked it around, Maurice and I, and so I think it's a good idea. And I just forgot it, you know. Most airplanes didn't have names, used their numbers. Because they always referred to me as the Jew Boy, you know, joking, you know, just the Jew Boy. And the Italians as the Wops and the Dagos. You know, you do it with a smile on your face. And so, it might be an idea anyway. We just kicked it around. So he actually did it. He actually did it. The guys weren't too happy, I don't think, with the name on the airplane. Because they felt that got a lot of attention, too much attention. They sort of didn't like the idea. One of the guys from the 37th would express the fact that he thought it was grandstanding. I said, well, maybe it was. I don't know. I just want
to. You also had the name in German on the opposite side?
He was going to do that, and I didn't want that. He wanted that. I said, no, I didn't want that.
Did you ever carry any kind of good luck charm or believe in that?
The only thing I ever did, every night, I read from the Bible and did the Shema and Be'er Torah Sadanoi and all that. And that's all I did. That's all I did. But, I had a mezuzah head around my neck with my dog tag. So if they found me, they captured me, they really would know.